Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello there and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments. Exclusively Latin for the first Pope ever to speak over the airwaves. A tightrope of faith. One cardinal draws back a Baltic iron curtain. And when opera was not allowed during Lent. Well, thanks for joining me.
A year ago, on Friday, March the 3rd, 2006, we had the privilege of receiving Pope Benedict XVI here at the radio, 75 years after it was founded by one of his predecessors to the See of Peter, Pius XI. To mark the anniversary of this special visit, I'd like to step back in time for a moment to February 1931, when our radio station was inaugurated. I do this by taking a look at that first historical papal speech over the microphones of Vatican Radio, delivered, as was the custom at the beginning of the 20th century, in Latin, the universal language of the Catholic Church. I do this by turning to Pope Benedict's own Latinist, Carmelite Father Reginald Foster.
Father, as you know, our radio station was founded by Pius XI on the 12th of February 1931, right? I had a little bit of trouble finding the Pope's first speech on our radio station, which was in Latin. I've had a little bit of trouble finding the Latin version, not in sound, but the actual text itself. What I found really interesting about this speech is how it's divided into categories. Basically, the Pope is speaking to all kinds of different categories. He starts by addressing creation, no?
Yeah.
He says,
Deus Christus imperat, which is still, you know, the theme song.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the first words that were transmitted.
Christus vincit, Christus regnat.
Christus imperat. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This was when talks were for a wireless. And how do you translate the word wireless?
Sine filis.
So why do we call it radio then?
Radiare is to, like, on the spokes of a wheel. You know, that's radiare. Radii are the spokes of a wheel. So to send out a message like the spokes on a wheel is to radiate. It's all Latin.
The text of the first radio message, I've been told, was written in Latin by Pope Pius XI himself. Is that possible, do you think?
Oh, yeah, certainly.
And he said, Listen, O heavens, to that which I say. Listen, O earth. Listen to the words which come from my mouth. Is that what he said?
Where the heavens, where the heavens? Audite hic omnes gentes, all you people, listen to these things. With ears, perceive all of you people who are dwelling on this earth. Ah, together, all together, the rich and the poor, may you and the islands hear, and people pay attention from far away. Oh, it's glorious. I don't know where you got the heavens from, but that's all right.
The passage we always hear, and when we use the first broadcast, we always use the first words, qui arcano de concilio. What does all that mean? Qui arcano de
concilio? We who by a secret plan of God, succedimus,
in loco,
follow up in the... In the place of the Prince of the Apostles. Got the idea?
Yeah. Eorum nempe quorum doctrina.
Namely, of those apostles whose teaching and preaching by divine command has been destined to all peoples and to all creation. Oh, it's glorious.
So,
and we who are...
Et predicatio, so we said, eorum nempe quorum doctrina.
Yes, and of those people, namely, whose teaching and preaching...
Et by predicatio.
By divine command, iussu divino, Christi nata est, has been destined to all peoples and to all creation.
Ad omnes gentes et ad omnem creaturam.
Oh... And he's going on with the radio. And we who first, in the very place, are able to enjoy Ope, okay, Mira Sane Ope Marconiana.
Mira Sane Ope Marconiana.
And by this marvelous Marconian help. That's the radio.
Which word is
well,
it?
Well, Ope, Ope, with the resources of the radio.
Ad omnia et ad omnes primo nos convert.
Okay, we turn ourselves to all things and to all people first. Hic et infra, here and below, I don't know, the sacred text helping us. We say, ah, here you are, oh, heavens, listen to the things which I say, and let the earth hear the words of my mouth. Mm. Oh, glorious.
How does this Latin compare to today's Latin?
Would this is much better than ours.
You wouldn't translate like this, would you?
No, because he wrote in Latin. Now we're translating. We are translating from another language into Latin, and this is artificial. This is real.
Mm. Pope Pius XI speaks about the Ope Marconiana, the work of Marconi, in other words, the radio.
Yes.
Marconi spoke in Italian.
Yes, yes, yes. But he says, we are able to enjoy and to use, of course, the marvelous help of Marconi.
Mm. Because Marconi spoke before the Pope, no? And he said...
I don't know. I don't know the story, really.
He said, I have the highest honour of announcing that in only a matter of seconds, the Supreme Pontiff, Pope Pius XI, will inaugurate the radio station of the Vatican City State.
Oh, how exciting.
The electric radio waves will transport to all the world his words of peace and blessing.
Marvellous, marvellous. Good, good, good.
How do you say all that in Latin?
Mi sumo honori est annunciare paucissimis omnino momentis pontificem supremum pium undecimum inauguraturum esse stationem radiophonicam urbis Vaticane. It's glorious.
And that's all for now, although we will be coming back to that speech in the next few weeks with our popular Latin lover, Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, the Pope's own Latinist. Meanwhile, moving on in the broadcast, I thought I'd turn my attention to a part of the world we rarely focus on these days, Lithuania, an overwhelmingly Catholic country, the largest and most southerly of the three Baltic republics. It recently established its place, as we know, in the Western family of nations by becoming part of the European Union, a move which marked the second historic shift in the nation's history following the collapse of the Soviet Union. And indeed a development which would have been extremely hard to believe in not-so-distant Soviet times. I've chosen to speak of this nation for two reasons. The first, to highlight the key role played by Vatican Radio in Eastern Europe before the fall of the Berlin Wall, and the second, to mark the feast day on Sunday of Saint Casimir, patron saint of Lithuania. So stay tuned as one eminent Lithuanian sheds light on the valuable historical memory of this Baltic nation. He's Cardinal Audrys Bačkis.
Your country of origin, Lithuania, has a checkered history, a painful history. It had a communist regime, a Soviet occupation for over 50 years, I think. It was interspersed with a Nazi occupation. During this period, the Lithuanians clung on to their faith. Is that a correct statement in your view? What are we talking about when we're talking about suffering and persecution of Catholics?
Certainly after the Soviet occupation, I mean the first one, in 1940, there was a lot of persecution against the church and the intellectuals. There was in June 1940, the deportation to Siberia, about 40,000 people, but they were chosen, the elite, 100 more priests, let's say the mayor of the village, the intellectual, things like that. So it was a very strong blow to the country, a lot of suffering, but people who have grown in a Catholic surrounding in the faith and were able, even in Siberia, even elsewhere, to keep the faith. It's wonderful now today. I saw some religious congregations, some girls who were born in Siberia. So it means that the parents were able, in this condition, where there were no priest, no church, nothing, to keep alive the faith. So then it was a persecution after the Nazi occupation for 4 years, and the most difficult thing at that time, sometimes some people had a sense of guilt, it was the persecution of the Jews. About 200,000 Jews were deported from Lithuania. Of course, it was done by the Nazis, but, well, many Lithuanians defend and took risk in defense, some other, as usual, or were passive or collaborate. But then, after the second occupation of 1944, the government wanted to take control of the church, beginning from the head. So it was directly against the bishops. We refused to collaborate, closing down the seminary, not closing down, putting a so-called numerus clausus, a maximum, up to 25 students. There were 400 seminaries before the war. So. The blow against the bishop is very simple. The Archbishop of Vilnius, Reinis, my predecessor, died in the prison of Vladimir already 50 years ago, in 1953. He was arrested in 1948, in 50 he died. Another bishop, Borisevich of St. Telšiai, in the north of the country, was executed in Vilnius itself. Some others were sent to the jail, so that in 1967 there was only one bishop left in all Lithuania for six dioceses. Some fled abroad, but those who remained in the country were really in very difficult situation. So the seminary was also one of the targets. You cannot enter the seminary if you have made higher studies and things like that. They were trying to keep the lowest level.
And what happened on a daily basis there?
And the daily control of all the life of the church. To make catechesis was forbidden. I mean, if you meet with three young people, it was a crime. And so the priests, little by little, were pushed to a ministry only of sacraments. They only distribute the sacraments, don't get out, don't have contact with the people, avoid all that. And the church survived, I would say, thanks to some very courageous priests, and mostly some very courageous lay people. I think it's the families, mostly the mothers, we were able to transmit what they believe in to their children, things like that. So it was a time of great witness of faith up to the martyrs, the persecution. But then our occupation in Lithuania lasted 50 years. It was not the Nazi occupation in France for 5 years. And you can understand in 50 years, with all the discrimination against the churchgoers, let's say, if we are a member of the party, you go to the church for marriage or you baptize your children, you lose your job. So many people were obliged to look for a compromise to survive, for the future of the children mostly.
Do priests have to hide their identity?
No, they have not to hide their identity, but they have a permit. And they were the best priests were very active, were moved from one parish to another for every 3 months by the ministry. And they're giving a permit of work, let's say, to the priest. And if you were not acting according to the will of the Ministry for Religious Affairs, or they take away from you this permit, and you cannot work so as a priest. And are obliged to stay in the place where we are assigned. Some of them were sent to make a odd kind of civil work. The actual bishop of Panevėžys, one of the rural dioceses of the country, waited 13 years to enter the seminary, renewing the youngest. Finally he entered, but he had difficulties afterwards, also obliged to work as a civil clerk for some time. And he was one of the founders of the Committee for the Defense of the Rights of the Christians, not only Catholic. So I would say it was a time where the church was very limited. We have a very heroic witness of some lay people, some priests, and the most important thing to help the people was, I would say, the Vatican Radio was transmitted to Lithuanian and passing the news even about what was happening in the country. Because in Lithuania, like under the communist regime, there was a complete control of the school and a complete control of the mass media. So when there was some violation of human rights, let's say, against children were seen by the teacher going to school, and they were scolded and sent away from the school, things like that. There was a chronicle of events of the Lithuanian church, was published since 1972, up to the independence, and was relating these facts. And the Vatican Radio was transmitted it back to the country. Of course, I remember I was working in Rome, we were trying to avoid to make too personal, not to quote names against the one or the other, but it make a big support.
It wasn't forbidden to listen to Vatican Radio?
Yes, it was forbidden. They were trying to hiding. But forbidden, you know, at the beginning was very real persecution, but later on in the last years, let's say, of communist regime, 10, 15 years before the freedom, already people were more free to do what they want. One bishop who came here told me, you go in a hospital and at the hour of the Vatican Radio, you hear all the transistor, everybody listening to the Vatican Radio publicly. Many things depend from the local Communist Party, the local Secretary General. If it was a harsh man fighting against the church, it was almost impossible to do anything. Some others were, well, making compromise and knowing the mood of the people. But to give you an example, Christmas was a working day. It was impossible to feast priests. They put all these limits to impede people to celebrate the feast, not only to go to the church, but even to take away this atmosphere of sacred feast, of rest. Well, I mean, the most thing, because all the Catholic instruction was impossible, the religious instruction, not in the school, but also in the church, was very difficult.
So they used a very subtle technique, really. It wasn't a crackdown as such, but it was...
At the beginning, yes. The era of Stalin, it was very strong. But later on, they used more psychological means. Let's say even a boy is entering a seminary. They told him, look, if you want to become a priest, you have to collaborate with us. Not persecuting, but also once a month we shall meet in a cafe, in a restaurant. You will tell me something about this professor, about that man, and things like that. But unfortunately, the young people began used to serve two masters, as said in the gospel, to serve the state and to serve the church, if they want to survive, to have a parish, to be able to work. So it was a subtitle, as you say. But at the beginning, the time of Stalin, well, let's remember, in 1948, we have over 200,000 people deported to Siberia. It was the time they introduced the kolkhoz, collective farms, so destroyed all the small property. Of course, you know, the peasants did not want the farmers to leave their place. So they were, all family were deported. I know the sister of my mother, my aunt, was deported with her husband and a boy of 18 years old. And they spent 15 years. They survived, thanks to God. They returned back to the country. But it was really persecution at that time. 200,000 people for a population of 3.5 million.
The KGB infiltrated seminaries now. Was there a sort of parallel church?
In Lithuania, there was never a church of the Pax movement or a church. And the people remained really faithful. Many bishops were difficult, like the Bishop of Vilnius. I am from Vilnius, was elected Bishop 61, Steponavičius, which is, for instance, he was put under forced residence outside of the diocese from 1961 to 1988. Because he refused to give instructions. They said, you have to prohibit your priest to make catechesis, you have to do that, to ordain these deacons and not the other one. He was fighting, no, in my conscience, this one is not worthy, I will not ordain. So for that, he was taken away, and the church remained without bishop for 30 years almost. But they remained faithful. I mean, the argument of that bishop, I told you have to do that. No, I cannot sign a document like that because it's against the will of the Holy See, it's against the will of the Pope, it's against the canon law.
So in other words, from what you're saying, the Catholic Church, in the hierarchy in particular, resisted the parallel church that the communist regime would have liked to have created, like in the other Soviet countries.
Yes, I don't know how they resisted. It was perhaps our tie with the Holy See, and I don't know, was very strong. And, well, it was the only possible thing to do. there was small collaboration. Let's say the rector of the seminary, I remember, was member of the Berliner Conference, which is an organization run by the communists. We tried to show the world that the church is free, things like that. But I know that man. He was an honest man, a good man. He said, if I don't go to participate at this meeting, I will lose a job in the seminary. I will not be able to do something.
So they were walking on a tightrope the whole time, no?
Yes. Or doing nothing. That's the worst case. I mean, those were not taking any risk, but it was a minority. But even those one never took position against, let's say, the church interests and things like that. They were afraid to do more in order to have a secure life. You can understand someone was turning back from Siberia, from Vorkut after 10 years, didn't want to have new troubles when he came back, you know.
Well, thanks there to Lithuanian Cardinal Audrys Bačkis for sharing with us these valuable memories. And finally, for some more reflective notes this Lenten season, we turn to our music historian, Monsignor Philip Whitmore, who focuses on the first of the sorrowful mysteries of the Rosary.
In Elgar's oratorio, The Dream of Gerontius, we follow the journey of an old man who dies and is led into the presence of God by his guardian angel. The angel speaks to Gerontius of his approaching judgment. She assures him that the prayers of his friends on earth are heard in heaven. And she tells him that he has a powerful advocate in another angel, the angel of the agony, the same who strengthened Jesus when he knelt alone in the Garden of Gethsemane. A few moments later, we hear the voice of the angel of the agony himself, interceding with Jesus for the souls of the dead. Was a masterstroke on the part of Cardinal John Henry Newman, the author of The Dream of Gerontius, to give a role to the Angel of the Agony at this point. He shows us that whatever trials we may have to face, Jesus understands and shares our sufferings, since he himself is no stranger to anguish of soul. He too went through his hour of agony in the garden, as we remind ourselves when we pray the first of the sorrowful mysteries. Let's turn our thoughts now to that scene in Gethsemane and listen to Jesus praying in great distress, "My soul is sorrowful to the point of death." That music comes from a little-known work by Beethoven, the oratorio Christ on the Mount of Olives, written in 1803. It was written to be performed in one of the theatres in Vienna during Lent, when opera wasn't allowed. Around this time, Beethoven was preparing to write his first opera, and it sounds as if he's flexing his operatic muscles in this work. Listen now to Jesus pleading with his Father. Music builds up towards the moment when our Lord implores the Father to take the cup of suffering away from him. Nimm den Leidenskelch von mir. In the next scene, Jesus is comforted by the angel. Unlike Elgar, Beethoven gives the role to a soprano. It's rather touching to listen to their duet and to picture them together in the garden, communing in a moment of prayerful intimacy as they anticipate the terrible events that are about to take place. I think you'll agree that this music deserves to be better known. Sometimes even great music goes out of fashion or passes into oblivion. Beethoven never heard the music I want to play next. It was completely unknown until Mendelssohn revived it in 1829, 2 years after Beethoven's death. I'd like to finish with a reflection by the Christian soul on contemplating our Lord in the Garden of Gethsemane, taken from Bach's St. Matthew Passion. The choir chants softly in the background, the oboe plays a beautiful counter-melody, and the tenor soloist sings, "I want to keep watch beside my Jesus. Ich will bei meinem Jesu wachen."
Warm thanks there, as always, to Monsignor Philip Whitmore, a music historian who's currently working as an official at the Vatican's Secretariat of State.
And that brings us up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. Thanks for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbury.
You've been listening to the English programme of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.